My name is Dr. Dora Ann Mills, and as our wonderful moderator mentioned, that I served as the state health officer in the state of Maine for 15 years. Hi, Paul. I just realized my deputy director is here. I didn't even see you come in. Former deputy director. About 8 years ago, we were doing some pandemic flu preparedness, and I decided it would be interesting to find out what happened in Maine in 1918 during the last huge pandemic to hit. So I asked our public health nurses around the state to go to their local libraries and dig out on microfiche the archives from the time period when the flu hit badly in 1918. We knew the time periods that hit each area of the state through looking at vital records and seeing when the death rates rose in each area. So we collected about 2,000 pages of newspaper articles and archives from the state, and I went through those just to flip through and find out what happened. The newspapers at the time were really much more written in much more story form rather than sound bites. And indeed, through this huge tragedy that hit across the world, the stories that emanated from the newspapers were just astounding. I'm just going to share a few points with you because what happened is in 2009, several years ago later, when I was still state health officer and we had the 2009 H1N1 pandemic, it was striking to me that some of the same lessons that we learned from reading through the articles from 1918 actually still applied. So I thought I'd share with you a few of those today. My slides and a fairly extensive handout is on the web. I uploaded it to the APHA website. And I do not have any personal relationships or financial relationships with anything to do with this, including the pandemic of 1918. This is a picture of from the Historical Society of there's a man standing outside in Portland, and they used to put posters up at the outside of the newspaper buildings to announce the news, and this was an announcement about the pandemic. And just to give you a brief background on the pandemic of 1918, as probably many of you know, this was just a tragedy that we can't even, it's hard to even imagine these days. It resulted in the highest death rate ever, including surpassing the Black Plague and many other known tragedies. In Maine, what we see here is a graph of the influenza pneumonia death rates going from 1892 to several years ago, and you can see the spike in 1918. At that time, we had about less than half the population we have now, and we had about 5,000 deaths due to influenza in Maine. And as with the rest of the country, we had more soldiers who died from pandemic flu who served in World War I than who died in combat. And here's the death rates in general from the same time period, and then again you can see the spike. And of course, what was quite striking was the death rates among young people, which is the reverse of what you see in seasonal flu. So there are four major lessons that I wanted to just briefly go through. One is the role of policy. Now, Lewiston, Auburn here, this is a notice to the citizens of Lewiston and Auburn, which are twin cities in the southern part of the state. And this is a notice from the local Board of Health saying that everything is closed, the schools, the theaters, the churches. They did keep the factories open. Now, Lewiston at the time had about 30,000 residents, almost half of whom were recent immigrants from French Canada. It was the home, it's on the Androscoggin River, and it's the home of a number of big textile mills. So lots of big tenement buildings. So they closed in Auburn across the river did not have many immigrants living there and was somewhat well-to-do and did not have any factories to speak of. So, but they did have a local board of health, and every town in the state at that time had a local board of health, which held all the authority for public health, pretty much almost all of it. As you know, the federal constitution confers public health authority in this country to states. States sometimes then confer to local authorities, sometimes keeps it. At this time, it was conferred to the local boards of health. So the local board of health in Lewiston closed the schools, the churches, and the theaters, but kept the factories open. Well, what happened was is that in the factories, about half of the workers were women. Almost all of them, again, recent French-Canadian immigrants. What happened to their children? They couldn't keep the factories open if the schools were closed. So within a couple of days, they opened the schools. And then the theater owners came to the Board of Health and said, well, wait a minute, people come to the theaters to keep warm. This is October now, early October, it's getting cold. And they said, you know, you need to keep the theaters open because we have Lewis is full of a lot of tenement buildings, they're unheated, people come to the theaters in the evening to keep warm. So then the Board of Health said, oh, okay, we'll keep the theaters open. Well, what you found then was that the schools were open again, the theaters were open, the factories were open, but the churches were closed. So there was a wonderful, this is a picture of the newspaper article, and the more, there's a further, almost the whole conversation is on the handout that's on the web. But there was the Monsignor for the Catholic Church in the area went to the Board of Health, appeared to the local Board of Health on October 10th, as you see there. And he asked Dr. Epstein, who was the chairman of the Board of Health, and he said, do you consider the factories and mills as public gatherings? Not in that sense, Dr. Epstein says. The factories and mills are necessary to sustain life. And the Monsignor then says, well, then you think the churches are not essential? They go on to have this fascinating discourse. I mean, it's on the handout. But what it taught me was the importance of making sure that our policies are built on the evidence that we have at hand, and that they're consistent with flexibility that's justifiable. In 2009, we had, you might remember, some of you around for that, that we did have, there were a lot of controversies about whether to keep schools open or closed at the beginning, particularly. And so we struggled with the same type of issues, what to keep open, what to keep closed. But what was important, I think, was that we worked together to make sure that we used the data, the information we had at the time, and be consistent. We have to have some flexibility, too, and it wasn't that it was done perfectly in 2009 in Maine or anywhere else. But I think this example from 1918 was such a premier example of the need to be consistent as well as provide some flexibility. The balance of authority was another major challenge. And as I mentioned, in 1918 in the state of Maine, almost all of public health authority was conferred to local boards of health. But the problem with that was that the state had almost no authority. And so the state of Maine, as you can see on the right, they're putting out newspaper ads asking for men and women to volunteer their services. Now, this is right after there was a huge expansion of the draft that spring and summer. So there were very few people to help out on the front lines of the pandemic because the draft had been expanded so much for World War I. So the state tried to provide some resources to municipalities. But what happened was the boards of health were so susceptible at that time to the political winds locally. So you had even towns like Lewis and Auburn, you had, you know, one and other twin cities, twin towns, where everything would be closed on one side of the river, and everything would be open on the other side of the river, and business was bustling because everybody was having to go across the river to go to the theater or go to the stores. And so the state director of health at the time, state health officer at the time, got really frustrated. And he was in the newspapers in November and December just really damning the local boards of health. And sure enough, the first law that was proposed in January when the legislature reconvened was a law to shift the balance of authority from the boards of health to the state. And you can see some of the quote from that law there. And I don't think that was perfect either. I mean, I think that what we've had in the last evolution, the last 95 years, I believe, is a much more of a balance where, and I think that's what the important lesson is from 1918, is that we need to have a balance of authority. So in 2009, we had a lot of resources from the federal government, both in terms of money and guidance. The state in Maine had authority for overseeing the pandemic, but the local municipalities In Maine, we don't have so much strong county governments, but we have municipal governments still, and the first responders have the authority to carry out strategies that are guided by the state. And I feel like our balance of authority is much healthier now than it was in 1918, and that was an important lesson from that. There were also two lessons, I think, from the urban area, and a lesson from the urban areas and lessons from the rural areas. In our urban areas, as I mentioned, in 1918, we had Lewiston and Portland, our two major cities, were, you know, almost half of which were had recent immigrants. And there were infrastructures in both cities, infrastructure in terms of health. They had hospitals. They had the local boards of health. But this infrastructure, this health system, was not available to the immigrants at that time. And so, for instance, in the city of Portland, as I mentioned, a lot of boards of health actually closed the churches, and they did in Portland. The bishop there protested to the local board of health and appealed it. It went all the way up to the Maine Supreme Court, and the Maine Supreme Court came down on the side of the local board of health, and they said, the law is a law. The board of health has the authority to close churches. So by this time, it was late October, and Portland, the Portland hospital, the main hospital in town, was closed to anybody with the flu. Anybody with means could hire a nurse to help take care of them at home, but they didn't want the flu hitting the hospital. But they had about half of the population were recent immigrants who had no access to the hospital and had bad flu. The flu was hitting them very hard, and they had no access to have nurses come into their homes. So the bishop went to the local board of health, and he said, I'll cut you a deal, because they were overwhelming the streets and the stores and everything, and they couldn't keep businesses open because all these immigrants were so badly affected by the flu. And he said, the bishop said to the Board of Health, you reopen the churches. Let us reopen the churches, and I'll start a new hospital within 2 weeks, and we'll take everybody, including with the flu. So they agreed. They compromised. They said, until it's really cold, we want you to have your church services outside. They had outdoor services. But indeed, he kept his word, and within 2 weeks, they opened a new hospital. And that hospital today still exists, and it's called Mercy Hospital, and it's the second largest hospital in Portland, and still serves many underserved. So the lesson here in the urban areas was the infrastructure existed but wasn't available. And I think in 2009, we had similar challenges. I mean, I would like to think in 2009 our healthcare system was much more accessible to our underserved populations. But we did indeed learn from City of Portland and our other health departments in cities reaching out to immigrant populations and other underserved populations that they didn't have the access that that we thought they had, and that reaching out to our vulnerable populations was so critical to make sure that they by access to the vaccine easily and other infrastructures. This is a Red Cross nurses in 1918 in Portland. Now the rural areas, the final lesson really comes from the rural areas. I think a lot of the stories that are really untold from the 1918 pandemic have to do with from the rural areas. When we looked at the death rates from the flu in 1918, our rural areas, which is those the top counties there, and all except for the one down in the south, those are very, very rural areas and were at that time. And they were actually the hardest hit. They had the highest mortality rates. And in fact, the stories from the newspapers were just heart-wrenching. Here is one from a French town, the northern part of the state. The Saint-Jean Valley is Acadian. And so this is from the newspapers, actually some to this day are still French. And you can see the quote here about how heart-wrenching the pandemic flu was hitting them. And I think in big part because rural areas, besides being sparsely populated, have in common for the most part that they don't have much infrastructure. So there aren't the systems of hospitals and healthcare that that you have in many other areas, in urban areas. And that was true in 2009 as well. One thing we had done with actually Paul Kunert's help and others is to use tobacco settlement funds in the about 10 years ago, to build more of a public health infrastructure that was statewide in Maine. And that came in, that was so valuable in 2009, because where they didn't have a robust health system, we did have these coalitions we were funding. And they got together and they worked with the infrastructure they had, the schools, the community health centers, and others, to make sure that they had robust pandemic 2009 H1N1 flu outreach and the like. So I think the lesson there was that the infrastructure that is lacking in many rural areas, it's very important to have public health infrastructure that reaches our whole country. And even today, the funding in public health funding in rural areas is much less per capita than it is in urban areas. And I think that's something that we just, as a country, we need to address. So in summary, and the four kind of major lessons that we need to have consistent policies, but some room for justifiable flexibility. We need to ensure that there's a checks and balances between federal, state, regional, local governments. And we need to make sure in our planning, our crisis planning, to identify vulnerabilities early. And in urban areas, that may be focused on identifying vulnerable populations and including them in the preparedness efforts and in the response. And in rural areas, that may include making sure that the infrastructure is robust enough to address any issue. And finally, I'm just reminded of the World War I poem, In Flanders Fields. And although it was written before the pandemic flu hit, I think it has an important message that we need to listen to those voices from our past, including from the 1918 pandemic flu, because they do have a number of lessons for us to this day. And that's my contact information, and there, again, our handouts and the slides are on the web. Thank you.